Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we talk with Lauren Molina and Jason Tam about their new CD release of Marry Me a Little. We also discuss reviews of Bronx Bombers at Primary Stages. We also talk about Honeymoon in Vegas at Paper Mill and a little bit of news, so please stay tuned.
Marry me a little, love me just enough, cry but not too often, play but not too rough. Keep a tender distance, so we'll both be free. That's the way it ought to be. I'm ready, marry me a little. Do it with a will. Make a few demands I'm able to fulfill. Want me more than others, not exclusively. That's the way it ought to be. I'm ready now.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for Sunday, October 13th, 2013. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this afternoon we have Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Welcome back, Peter.
Thank you.
We missed you.
Aren't you nice?
Our schedules didn't mesh for the last couple of weeks, but we're glad to get back together. Also with us this morning is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com, as well as many other places on the internet. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
With us this morning, we have special guests. We have Lauren Molina and Jason Tam, who did a little show together at the King Company called Marry Me a Little. And we want to thank you for being with us on a Sunday morning. Thanks for getting up.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Absolutely. So you did the Marry Me a Little production at the King Company, and now you have a CD coming out. I guess the CD is in digital version. It's out already, and it's this disc. The discs are going to be in stores in November. So tell us about the transition from doing the production to doing the recording. Did you do the recording during the production, or did you take a break after?
We did not. We took a big old break So it was actually really fun to get to revisit all of that stuff, and especially because the staging of it was, you know, we're running around our apartment. We're these young, energetic, you know, 20-somethings at home alone on a Saturday night, and so it was nice to get to just sing the music and the words and to not be like jumping over a bed. I don't know, Lauren, how do you feel?
Yeah, I agree. And it was really cool to like be intimate with the, you know, the music and the microphones, because when we performed it, the way that the Clermont Theater is shaped, it's a very long space and not very deep. And, you know, the piano is on one side, but you know, it's not meant for a musical. So, you know, we were really pushing our voices at times to be heard in intimate moments. And I think
there was no, the original production wasn't mic'd at all. It was all just how it sounded. Yeah.
So I really had fun with the fact that we could be, you know, up into the mics and you know, really get nuanced versions of these songs and have them recorded for posterity.
It's interesting. I'm sure everyone is different, you know, and it depends, but do you think that maybe it's better to have a break like that? I mean, I think it might be difficult while you're doing a show to go into a studio. I mean, aside from the fact that, you know, that everyone is really kind of tired from doing the show 8 times a week, right. You know, just to go in and say, oh, well, this is it. This is going to be forever, and we're putting it down now, and to make it, you know, to make it as fresh and spontaneous as possible. I would think that all of the things being equal, it might be nice to have a break like that, because maybe when you come back to it, it helps the spontaneity and the you know, the freshness of it.
Sure. Yeah. I would say that, you know, I've done both kinds of cast albums where we've done it during the show and done it after. And I loved coming back to it after a few months, especially with some vocal rest and, you know, having you know, having a fresh take and, you know, some time away. I thought that was a great idea, actually.
I completely agree too. I mean, I it was a very vocally challenging show for me. And you know, we're singing the entire time and it was really, really nice to not have to be worrying about doing 8 shows and whether or not I can maybe do this vocal growl at this moment, because, you know, if I do that, it might throw off my voice for the entire rest of the run. So, it was great. I much prefer it doing a cast recording while not doing the show.
Yeah. Your point about the shape of the configuration of the theater was well taken. I hardly ever had a problem hearing in it. It was maybe only when the person was on the complete opposite side of the stage and facing away from me.
Right.
But it was so great, obviously, to hear, you know, to hear something like that acoustically.
And I think, yeah, it's absolutely refreshing when you do see a musical without amplification. Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. Now, all these songs were cutouts. Well, virtually all of them were cutouts from the shows from which they were intended. Were there any that made you say, wow, this song is so good, I'm amazed they dropped this song? How could they have dropped this wonderful song from that show?
I mean, all of them.
All of them. Like, sometimes B-sides are better than, like, everyone else's A-sides.
Oh, absolutely. Well, There Won't Be Trumpets is, I forget, was that in your show? That's my candidate for maybe one of the all-time greatest cut songs ever written.
Yes, absolutely. And I guess if I had to pick one, I'd probably pick for the songs that I sang, it would be Happily Ever After. And also Silly People. I think Silly People is haunting and beautiful and gorgeous, and it speaks to a very deep, you know, human sadness that is kind of I don't know, intriguing to me.
I saw both of those numbers, by the way, when they were performed in their shows in Boston, both Happily Ever After and Silly People, and I can certainly tell you that Dean Jones' eyes widened when he was singing Happily Ever After, because he saw it wasn't going over with the audience, that they were really resisting that message at that point in time. Of course, many years have passed, and people now can take it in a way that they couldn't then, but that was quite a statement then. Silly People did just sit there. I mean, it did seem to slow the show down, so I understood why it was cut. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, yes, this is not a comment on the worth of the songs. Both songs are terrific, there's no question. But yeah, as we all know, sometimes things have to go in shows just because they're slowing things down and not helping.
That's
well,
right.
Yeah, I was just reading notes about Little Night Music, and they said the song itself is just beautiful and haunting, as Jason said, but it's a combination of the fact of the placement of it and also the fact that that character we barely heard from before that. You know? So
you're 1 year away from this production at the Keen Company. You wrapped up October 27th last year. So in a year of retrospect, and it's nice that this project, when you do an off-Broadway show, you usually don't get to revisit it so quickly. So here you are a year later and promoting the CD release, but you also have a lot of other things going on. So let's talk a little bit about both of your histories on Broadway, and we'll have to start with Jason because his history goes way back, doesn't it, Jason?
Yeah.
It does. I was a little tyke. I played Gavroche in Les Mis in, I don't know, maybe like 1993. I was 10 years old and with all these fantastic people who I didn't know how fantastic they were. They were just fun to hang out with. But, you know, like Andrew McCardle and Sarah Uriarte, who's now Sarah Uriarte Berry, and Craig Shulman. Yeah. I mean, just amazing people. So yeah, I did Les Mis when I was 10 years old.
So how did you, did you live in the area, or were you plucked out of some other place and brought to New York, or?
Yeah, well, I grew up in the Hawaiian Islands, and there was a Canadian tour that came through, and they wanted some local kids to hop on for the Hamilton, Ontario stop, and then Honolulu, Hawaii. And so I did that for about 3 months, and they keep everybody on file because they go through those kids so quickly, because once you hit, you know, a certain height or your voice changes, you get booted, basically.
Yeah.
So they kept me on file, and they had an opening in New York and asked if I wanted to come do it here for 6 months. And so the answer was a resounding yes.
That's great. Did your parents come with you, or how did that work out?
My mom did. She came with me, and I'm so forever grateful for her, because she just up and left and came and, you know, lived in Manhattan. And my dad and my two sisters stayed in Hawaii.
Okay, how long did you do it?
6 months.
All right. And after that 6 months was over, was that because the show closed, or what happened?
No, actually, it kept running for quite a while, but that was the end of my contract, and I started to, you know, get a little tall. So I went back to Hawaii and finished out just having a regular old Hawaii childhood there.
Was that hard? Did you miss it? Did you miss it terribly? Did you miss it at all? Were you glad to be back? What?
I did miss it in the end. I think for the first half that I came here, it was exciting, but it was a little weird, and it didn't feel like home, and everything was new, and, you know, meeting all these new kids in school, and it's a big change, so it was hard. But by the end of my time here in New York, I really, really, really grew to love it. So it was hard to leave. But then, of course, once you get back home, you're in Hawaii, and it's great, and your family's around you, and, you know, you forget all about it because you have the ocean and the mountains.
Well,
it's great.
Byok Lee told me that when she was a little girl and she was in The King and I and it closed, that she literally shook her fist at the marquee and said, "Broadway, I'll be back." Did you have the same type of feeling?
I totally believe that, and I can see her doing that.
Well, Jason, they keep bringing back Les Mis, so maybe you can like keep graduating to other roles. Maybe this time you can be Marius or you know, Enjolras, and then you know, in 15 or 20 years from now, you can do Valjean, you know.
I can't wait to be an old man so that I can play Jean Valjean.
Let me say, if you can't wait to be an old man, don't worry about it. It'll come very quick.
You know, some productions, you don't have to wait to be an old man.
Right.
That role.
That's true.
All right.
So let's skip over to Lauren. Lauren, give us your background, because it seems as though I can't find anything about you before your big splash on Broadway with Sweeney.
Well, that's because, no, I'm just kidding.
She could tell us, but she has to kill us.
Right, exactly. So I grew up in Detroit. I am the daughter of a dancer and a bass player. My dad is the principal bassist with the Detroit Symphony. I'm sort of destined to perform. I was exposed to music and art from a very young age. I grew up just doing sort of like school productions.
Do you know the Kenan Bolgers?
I did, and actually we went to the same elementary school.
Stop or something.
Yep. It's weird. Actually, awesome. Celia and I have had a very, very similar path. We've played the same roles in different productions, and like on paper, we're like, on paper before like 2010, we're the same person. It's really weird, you know. And I like, I even know that we like dated the same guy at two different points of our lives. It's very, but I love her so, so much. And, you know, now I think our paths are, and our types are a little bit different now. I love her, and I can't wait to be in a show with her and Andrew, as well. I have a band called the Skivvies, which we might get to later, but he's performed with us, and he actually lives in my building. So I like, yes, the Kenan Bolgers are very close to me.
A lot of star-crossed there.
I know. So anyway, I went to the University of Michigan, also.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Also a place where Celia went and Andrew. And I graduated in 2003.
Wait a minute. Favorite roles include?
From college?
Yeah.
Iola Stover in Parade.
Wow.
Mabel in The Most Fabulous Story Ever Told.
Uh-huh.
Let's see. Those are my standouts. It's funny because in college, I wasn't like the favorite, and I did a lot of like sort of student directed underground black box productions. I was sort of the black sheep, but I definitely made my made my way and kind of, you know, did things that were outside the box. And when I graduated, I met with a teacher who I was like, "What's your advice for when I go to New York?" And he was like, "Lauren, you know, you're never going to be in Oklahoma. You're never going to be, you know," and he's like, "You're never going to be in this. You're never going to be in that. You're not going to be in the ensemble of this or that." He's like, "What you do is different and you're unique, and you should just write your own show and play your cello and play your guitar and write your own material, because, you know, I think, you know, the uniqueness of you will make you stand out." And actually that's exactly what happened with Sweeney Todd when, you know, they were looking for a soprano cellist who, you know, was edgy and could act and, you know. So, but before I got my big break on Broadway, I got my Equity card doing the Just So Stories, a National Theater Works tour.
Oh, good.
So that was my humble beginnings. Mm-hmm.
That's great. So when you see a breakdown that says we need a soprano that plays the bass, you feel like, should I go in for that?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the stretch.
Yeah. Sondheim, things like that. Also, you have a little bit of a, can I say, an opera background?
I do, yeah.
And tell us about that.
So when I went to college, I was very academic growing up, and I thought, oh, you know, I'm just good at this musical theater thing. It's not something, like, I know how hard it is to be an actor. I don't necessarily want that life. I want to, you know, do something that is more stable. So I went to the University of Michigan, and I still was undecided about my major. And I was taking all these, like, you know, philosophy, psychology, history courses my first year. But then I sort of missed the bug, and I had the bug, and I, you know, missed performing. And I auditioned for the music school choir, and I got in. And in the first year, I was promoted from the main choir to the chamber choir, which is the upper whatever tier. And so I was like, oh, wow, people think I'm a good singer. Cool. And then my sophomore year, I transferred to the music school to major in opera. And after I was there for a year, I just felt like I really want to communicate in English. I don't want to be in school. I want an immediate, you know, interaction with the audience. I I know that opera singers can do that, but I just wasn't feeling it. I feel like I have more of a contemporary edge. And so I auditioned for the musical theater program, and I transferred in to the musical theater program in my junior year. But since I already had, like, since it's not a conservatory program and I already had, you know, the music school requirements fulfilled from my voice major previously, I basically just entered as a junior into the musical theater program. So,
by the way, oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were done. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to ask if Sondheim was hands-on on this production. Did you meet him? Was he good to you? Did he have nice things to say? Did he just show up opening night and leave it at that?
Jason?
He came to our first rehearsal, and it was my heart stopped a little bit. It was so great. For the most part, he was pretty hands-off. I mean, I think when our director, Jonathan Silverstein, and our music director, John Bell, had any questions about any certain lyrics, he was, you know, very responsive to giving his input on that. But for the most part, he just kind of let us do our own thing. He came to one of our previews and gave a couple notes, but he was and then came to opening, and he was very supportive. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so great that you got to record it. I mean, I guess in this case, aside from everything else, there was the rationale that there were quite a few different songs than in the original Marry Me a Little with Craig Lucas and I always forget the other lady.
Suzanne Henry.
Yeah, yeah. But that's great that you got to, you know, that you got to preserve it like that.
Yeah, I mean, and because the only recording that exists of this material is that original cast album, we really felt like it was important to preserve these songs. And also, you know, we got the blessing of Sondheim and Craig Lucas to add new songs to the piece and to rearrange them, to reorganize them to what best fit our storytelling. So you know, we really had something that felt very fresh and original.
So back to Jason for a second. We just want to touch upon how you ended up in Chorus Line as Paul, or did you have a big background in dance?
I started dancing my freshman year of high school, and which I guess is maybe kind of a little late, but I feel like guys can get away with starting dance later on in their lives than usually women can. But yeah, I fell in love with dance, and for like 2 years, I stopped doing, you know, community theater and school theater, and just totally devoted myself to going to dance classes almost every single day. I came to school here in New York. I went to NYU Cap 21 at Tisch, and so I continued to dance in their program there. Shortly after I graduated, there was an open call for a Chorus Line that I went to, and I made it through that. And this was the very beginning of a very long and lengthy audition process, mm-hmm. and I was actually out of town for like the next 8 months. So I feel very lucky because I got to miss most of like the very arduous callback process, and kind of came in right at the end, and was so happy and grateful to be a part of that show.
Well, not only did you have a major role in the show, but also in the documentary, Every Little Step. And I did want to ask you about that. I got to see the show in San Francisco and on Broadway, by the way, which was really great to see it, you know, kind of move and grow. Yeah. But are you, I mean, this also may be hard to answer. Were you, how conscious, if at all, were you of the fact that there was these cameras there while you were performing this wrenching monologue, you know, as for your audition for Paul?
I was very conscious of them. It was like it was very jarring, and it felt I'm not gonna lie, it felt very invasive, and yeah. And it wasn't a great feeling to have these cameras following you. But having said that, I'm so glad that they did, and that they caught this. I think they told the story of actors very, very well and with a lot of heart, and so I'm so grateful that they did it. But yeah, it was hard to have them around.
Did anybody come by the stage door afterwards and talk about their relationship to Paul, the character, anything like that, that you heard some interesting or poignant stories from people who said, that's my life, or anything like that?
Yeah. I never got the chance to get into people's specific stories, because I'm sure that it's they're meaty and that it's a lot. But there were people that came up and said, you know, I was so touched. It's so nice to see that story being told and to be able to relate to that. And you know, that's all you can hope for.
Jason, were you still in the show when Mario Lopez went in it?
I wasn't. We didn't overlap at all.
Oh, I was wondering if you could.
Yeah, I had left by that point.
I was wondering if you could confirm or debunk the Nick Adams story, but maybe not. Oh well.
Yes, I've heard of that story as well.
So we're going to get into our time traveler right now and go to the future, where Jason is starring in If Then. So that's coming up for you, huh?
It is. I'm so excited. We leave for Washington D.C. this Wednesday to be at the National Theater. And it's a fantastic cast. I mean, if you would have asked or told, you know, 16-year-old Jason Tam, who was singing along to the entire Rent album in his car, that, you know, he would be singing along with like Idina and Anthony, he literally just crash into like five different people and die. It's a great cast. It's a great, you know, creative team. A Pulitzer Prize winning Tom Kitt and Brian Yorkey and Michael Greif directing it. It's a dream come true.
All righty. And Lauren, we want to touch upon Rock of Ages for a second and also talk about the Skivvies, which you alluded to earlier. So am I mistaken? Did the Skivvies kind of concurrently happen with Rock of Ages? Did Skivvies happen after Rock of Ages?
It happened after Rock of Ages, and it happened after Candide. It actually like was sort of born right around it happened last year in like February, we started making videos. And then our first live performance was at Joe's Pub last August. So it was like sort of right around the time when Marry Me a Little was starting to get together. And
Oh, I think I saw this first performance. I didn't realize it would only a year ago. That's incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We featured it on Broadway Stars in the videos a few times. So I thought it was actually older than that. That's great. Why don't you explain what the Skivvies are for folks who don't know yet?
Sure. So the Skivvies are a musical duo, comedy pop group that consists of me and my best friend, Nick Searley. And we strip down pop, hip hop, rap, rock, we throw in all kinds of genres of music, but we strip it down musically to be on the ukulele and cello mostly. But we also strip down and perform in our underwear, and it's all very tongue in cheek. There's nothing dirty or raunchy about it at all. And it's all just part of like the play of it. And we get big Broadway names and fun people to join us at concerts and special guests, where we make all of our own arrangements and mashups specifically, for those guests. And it's basically like a really fun experience and a laugh a minute with our crazy arrangements and our really amazing guests. So, and it started out of Nick and I have been making music together for almost 10 years with our clothes on. And we, last year we decided to do a cover of Rihanna's We Found Love, which is like a very electronic dubstep sounding piece of music. And we decided to strip it down for ukulele and guitar and make it into a waltz. And but when we were trying to figure out what to wear, I was having like one of those days where I'm like, nothing looks good. I'm walking around in my bra. And Nick says, just wear that. And I said, well, we are stripping down the music and we could make it like, that's pretty funny irony if we just perform these trite lyrics by Rihanna and we're like essentially exposing the lyrics of all this bad pop music and, exposing ourselves at the same time. And, and then my boyfriend, after we put that up, he said, you should be called the Skivvies. And it just suddenly clicked. And now it's this like small business that we have and we're performing all the time all over the place. And so it's great.
Well, talking about video that may or may not be intrusive, I was online this morning and somebody posted a link to a video of your performance on Friday night with Jeremy Jordan. And then that led me to another one of Ro Hartranft performing with you on. So, I mean, do these people in this internet age and this immediate YouTube age, does that enter into maybe whether people say, oh, I don't know if I want to do that or not?
Well, yeah, I mean, or yes, I absolutely want to do that. Like, we have people that come up to us all the time and say, oh my God, I want to perform at the Skivvies. I have all these great ideas. I get texts from Morgan James at like 3 a.m. I just woke from a dream and I want to do a mashup of this song. And, and certain people are intimidated by it, but the truth is they don't have to like strip down. It's not about staying naked. It's not about, it's about like the playfulness element of the song and the music. It's all about the music. And to be perfectly honest, like, people didn't notice, our band until we took our clothes off. But then once you listen to us, you forget that we're in our underwear. It's all about the music and it's all about the creativity of the arrangements. And, with Jeremy Jordan, he was actually at first like,
In a fedora and a trench coat, right?
Yeah, he starts in a fedora and a trench coat. But, like, he didn't want to necessarily wear his underwear. And I was like, well, you don't have to. But then once he saw how it all worked, he just jumped right into it and was totally game and had a blast. And it's totally weird. We did a mashup for him of TLC's Creep and Radiohead's Creep, throwing in a little bit of Jeepers Creepers. And it's totally bizarre and awesome and fun and weird. And his voice is like butter. So it's like the perfect storm.
It's very creative. It really is. And congratulations to you on thinking or or to your boyfriend of thinking of the hook, because yeah. I think you're right. You know, it is what gets people in, or, you know, maybe to some degree. But, you know, if the music wasn't great, they you know, it wouldn't mm-hmm. still be going on.
Exactly. And, you know, and I love that it's something that is so original and, you know, something that I made with Nick, and, you know, it's like our little baby that's just keeps on going and growing.
Yeah. And and specifically the mashup aspect of it, and the, you know, so many genres being kind of melded together, that to me is maybe the greatest thing about it.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
So let's wrap up here. I want to tell everybody that you can find Lauren at laurenmolina.com. You could also follow her on Twitter at lomo212. So twitter.com/lomo212. And Jason as well, Jason Tam, jasontam.net, where his website is. And also you can follow him on Twitter at Jason W. Tam. So thank you guys so much for joining us on a Sunday morning and telling us about your new CDs and projects.
Thanks for having us.
Check it out. It's awesome.
All right. You have a great day. Take care.
Bye.
All right, you too. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
And I'll stay cozily hiding by day. During the day I'll resign, waiting till you go away. But at 9, master of all I survey, everything gets to be mine to own, mine to use, mine to write all the poems I choose. All alone, only me and my muse.
And 40 pianos and 10,000 shoes.
That was very nice of them to join us. We went a little bit longer than we wanted, but it was so interesting. I let it keep going. Michael, tell us about that Nick Adams story.
Oh, yeah. I guess, you know, just to clarify for people who didn't hear it, there was when Chorus Line opened, Nick Adams was in the show. And he is noted, among other things, for having a pretty spectacular body. And he the rumor was that when Mario Lopez went into the show, that Nick's costuming was changed so that his body wouldn't be shown off because Mario would not be shown up in that regard. And you know, I still wonder to this day if that was just complete publicity, you know, for the show, or if there was any, you know, any truth to it. I kind of think the former, but I was hoping Jason would know if he was still in the show at that point. And, you know, he might not have told us anyway, but it's just,
well, you know, it's a shame we didn't mention it while they were with us, because we could have had a skivvy off. Had both of them. Have Lauren bring them down to Joe's pub and have a skivvy off. So anyway, and with that, Shikaboom Records and the production has given us 3 copies of the CD to give away. So if you send us an email with the title Nick Adams in it, with your name and mailing address, the first 3 people to do that will get the CDs. And the CD giveaways have been going good, so get in on the fun. Lots of people doing it.
And who knows, maybe we'll see Nick Adams in Marry Me a Little someday.
Exactly. So on to our reviews. Peter and Michael got to see the show Bronx Bombers. So Peter, why don't you start us off with that and tell us what you thought?
Well, this is written by Eric Simonson, who also was responsible for 2 other sports-oriented shows, Lombardi, that was done in Circle and Square, about a football coach, and Magic Bird, which is about 2 basketball players. So I guess it was only inevitable that he'd get around to baseball. Here it is, Bronx Bombers, of course, about the Yankees. And it starts out in very interesting fashion. There was a big incident that, frankly, I didn't even think of was so big. But, you know, when they started talking about it, I realized this was really something that back in 1977, Billy Martin, who was then manager of the Yankees, pulled Reggie Jackson, the famous superstar who famously had a candy bar named after him, as he predicted he would if he came to New York. He pulled him out of a game in the middle of an inning. Now, that really is something, because I don't know how much people know about baseball, but the thing is, if a player comes out of the game, traditionally it's between innings. And if Billy Martin had taken Reggie Jackson out of a game between innings, nobody would have thought much of it. It might have been he was tired. It might have been a mutual decision. But to actually pull him out of an inning means that the manager is making a decision independent of the ball player. And Reggie Jackson, who had an ego the size of Rhode Island, which may not be a big state, but it's big for an ego, was very insulted by this. And so what we're talking about, the play takes place the next day after this incident has happened, when Yogi Berra is trying to be a peacemaker. Now, one of the most interesting things about the show is that Yogi Berra has always been known for his strange way of seeing things and the way he expresses himself. One example out of millions would be when he was in a restaurant and he ordered a pizza, and they said, "Would you like cut into 8 slices or 6 slices?" And he said, "6. Oh, 6. I could never eat 8 slices." You know, so I mean, there's a lot of that in this play. However, what's really interesting to me is Eric Simonson has really characterized him as a very good peacemaker. And I thought that was really terrific, that he may not have a command of the language, but when it comes to managing people, and indeed, he did manage the Yankees for a period of time, that he was really very good at seeing both sides of a situation and trying to get people together rather than drive them apart. So I thought that was really, really good. Okay. Well, the second act gets a little strange. It gets a lot strange, actually. And one of the reasons is because at the end of the first act, either Berra is having a breakdown or a hallucination or a dream. It's not quite clear, and it's not important whether it's clear or not. But in the second act, suddenly he is dealing with many Yankees who came before him and came after him at a dinner that he and his wife seem to be hosting. So you go as far back as Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and Joe DiMaggio, and you go as far forward as Derek Jeter. So that's and it becomes very, very strange where people are talking about baseball now, then, that type of business. And I guess what it is, after writing two plays that were realistic, suddenly he wanted to do something tremendously different and unexpected, and he did. And while it's watchable, it's not exactly compelling. So it's a little bit of a letdown after the first act, which does have more drama. Now, in terms of performances, the gentleman who plays Reggie Jackson, Francois Batiste, is really remarkable in how much he resembles him. But this turns out to be a problem in the second act.
Yes.
Because then he's playing Elston Howard, a ball player from the 50s, a black ball player who, one of the point is that he never gets his due and he's not very much remembered today, even though he was a tremendous ball player at the time. And as he points out, even won a Most Valuable Player award. But he's not really remembered. And there is an implication that he was a bit of an Uncle Tom, because in the 50s, it was hard to be a black ball player on a team. And he was the first one the Yankees ever had. But the thing is, he still looks like Reggie Jackson. I mean, there was a real problem there. You know, you really felt you were watching Reggie. The gentleman who plays Mickey Mantle, Bill Dawes, also plays Thurman Munson, who's very much in the first act, and makes many allusions to flying a plane, which indeed would kill him when he crashed, I think the following year. And boy, he's really good at looking like both Thurman Munson and Mickey Mantle, which is really quite impressive. And Keith Nobbs looks very much like Billy Martin. The others are not as effective. The Babe Ruth is all wrong in terms of the way he looks. He doesn't remotely resemble Babe Ruth. Lou Gehrig is okay. Joe DiMaggio's okay. But let's take our hat off to Richard Topol for Yogi Berra, because he had to come in with very short notice. There was artistic differences between the director and the original leading man. And this is the leading part of the show. He's the one, you know, Reggie always talked about being the straw that stirs the drink, but in this show, it's Yogi Berra. And so Richard Topol gives a terrifically good performance under any circumstances, but the fact that he was close to a last-minute replacement makes it even more impressive. And he kind of resembles Yogi Berra, but nevertheless, considering he's a replacement, we'll give him a pass on that. You know, they're lucky to have him. And so this is a curious night in the theater. You know, I was pretty impressed at how many people in the audience seem to be baseball fans and following it ardently. And especially in intermission, I heard a lot of talk where people who knew baseball were instructing those who didn't. But what was interesting to me was that those people who didn't know baseball were eager to learn what was going on. It wasn't like they threw their hands up and said, well, I'm just not interested. The hell with it. I'm going home. The play held them enough at that point to make them ask questions of the savants in the lobby. However, I have to wonder if after that strange second act, if they were glad they stayed.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
Yeah, very interesting. Just to clarify, the whole first act of the play is very realistic, and it takes place in a hotel room in the Boston Sheraton in June 1977. And the actual the players represent, you know, who are present on this occasion for this kind of meeting that occurs in the aftermath of Billy Martin pulling Reggie Jackson out of the game. So we have Yogi is there. We have, let's see, we have Thurman Munson. We have Billy Martin. We have Reggie Jackson. And I guess that's, yeah, that's it. Then at the end of Act One, isn't it that Yogi, he falls asleep. Getting ready to go to bed. And I think maybe even there's, isn't there a reference to him having indigestion or something like that? Mm-hmm. And yeah. And so Act Two opens in this very fanciful, you know, dream sequence with a very large, round table with chairs around it, you know, in a very elegant setting, dinner setting. And that's where all these former Yankees Yankees from all different eras show up. And then after that sequence ends, the final scene is in the Yankees locker room in September 2008. And that's kind of the coda to it. So that's the structure of the play. My take on this play is I liked it much better than Magic Bird, which was Eric Simonson's second sports themed play by the same producers, by the way. But not as much as Lombardi, which I think at this point is the best of the three. It's interesting to see the differences and the similarities. In this play, the role of Carmen Berra, Yogi's wife, played by Wendy McKenna, functions in a very similar fashion to Lombardi's wife in the first play. I don't remember her first name. But as Peter said, the other two plays didn't have dream sequences, as I recall, that's admirable, showing Eric Simonson trying to move in different directions. I really enjoyed the first act and the last scene. Like Peter, I was somewhat confused by the dream sequence. Aside from everything else, I thought it was confusing to me that some of the players, as the scene began, some of them were in pinstripes, some of them were not. For example, Joe DiMaggio was in a suit, and that just made it even a little more confusing, you know, as to what the point was supposed to be. But I really did enjoy the first act. I don't remember that incident, because I've never been a baseball fan, but it does certainly sound very dramatic, and it's certainly presented in a very dramatic way of Billy Martin pulling Reggie out of the game. Sports is theater in a very real way. Not so many shows, although there certainly have been some, like Damn Yankees, but so many movies, you know, about sports. And
as I like to say, both have runs. both have hits, both have errors, you know, so they do.
Yeah, that's great. I don't think I've ever heard you say that before. That's great. And I'm sure there are other things that they have in common. But yes, I do think it was a big mistake to have Francois Baptiste play those two roles, especially if he wasn't able to delineate them more clearly. But I absolutely agree. Bill Dawes was almost unrecognizable as Thurman Munson, as opposed to Mickey Mantle. I mean, he looked completely different in both roles. And if I didn't know it was him, and then I didn't have the playbill, and I hadn't seen the actor before, I don't think I would have realized it was the same person. That's how extraordinary the transformation is. Peter was wondering if, as a non-baseball fan, how that affected my enjoyment. I still was really with it. There were things I knew, things I did not know. I did remember that Thurman Munson died in a plane crash. So when that foreshadowing came in, that you kind of hear people in the audience kind of like gasp a little bit, or you know, just murmur a little, and that was very effective. And I knew what that meant. I didn't know. Keith Nobbs is so terrific as Billy Martin, and then later as a sports reporter. Almost everyone in this show plays two roles. But he early on, he in the meeting in the hotel room, he starts to cry at one point, and then he cries again, and then I think he cries again, and I didn't know. I assume that Billy Martin was famous for that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
see, I didn't know that, but I kind of got it after a while. So, I think it was well done. I think it was well written in terms of appealing to people who are sports fans and non-sports fans. So I definitely think that Eric Simonson deserves credit for that.
Not only should we that, but I want to mention the fact that the place was quite packed the night I went. Now, I don't know how many tickets were given away or anything like that, but it seemed to me that these were real civilians in the seats who were interested. Granted, the Duke Theater on 42nd Street isn't a big palatial place, but nevertheless, I've been in that place many times where there have been empty seats for plenty of productions, but everyone was taken on Friday night, so this may turn out to be a word-of-mouth hit.
Well, and there is a small equivalent to the bleachers section. It looked like quite a small balcony, if that's the word for it. But it's funny, Michael Dale, our friend, was there that night, and he said, well, you know, there's a tradition of fans in the bleachers chanting the names of the players, and like they'll keep chanting until the players kind of like, you know, wave to them.
Knowledge, yeah.
Yeah, he said, and you know, I kind of expected any minute to hear, Bill Dawes, Bill Dawes. But that didn't happen.
Well, you know, Peter, I think that it might have been booked solid because usually the Yankees are busy in October, but they're at home right now.
Well, what a good point that is. Yeah, which nobody can deny. Yeah, yeah, that's very much true.
I'm hearing, you know, a rumor that that this play is still eyeing Circle in the Square, where Lombardi played, because we now have heard that. Well, actually, isn't it today that Soul Doctor is closing? Who knows? You may see it at Circle in the Square.
All right. Well, let's move forward to Michael and Peter got a chance to see Honeymoon in Vegas at Paper Mill Playhouse. I'm actually going tonight. And so I'd love to hear what you guys thought about it. Michael, why don't you start us with that?
I loved it. I thought it was so fantastic. I thought I was trying while it was happening to think of anything I could suggest, and the only thing I could come up with was two things. There's this Flying Elvis number at the end, and I thought it went on like just a little bit too long, but I'm talking like maybe like 8 measures that they could have cut out of the middle of it, because the opening of it is fantastic and the ending is fantastic. It just seemed maybe a little too lengthy for that point in the show. And then the other thing is I thought that when the main character, when he lands in his parachute, I thought it would have been funny if like a chute had come down and like covered him after he landed, and that would have been very funny. But I don't know if that's just logistically too difficult So who knows? Maybe when it moves to Broadway, as it unquestionably will very soon, I'm sure. Maybe they'll add that, you know, as a kind of a increased, enhanced production value. But oh God, the score was so terrific by Jason Robert Brown. Just in a really old, conventional, jazzy, swingy Las Vegas style, but with lyrics that are so clever and with up to the minute references, like the rhyme, rhyming Beyonce with fiance, that just made it all seem incredibly fresh. As I said to a friend, I have a friend who is very, very conventional in his taste, and he tends to not like a lot of the music written by the younger crop of composers today. But I said to him, well, I said, regardless of how you feel about whatever Jason Robert Brown has written in the past, you're going to love this, because it sounds like Golden Rainbow, you know, mm-hmm. or one of those really fabulous. It sounds like some of Julie Stein's greatest stuff. It's just fantastic. And the book, how often does this happen? The book is written by Andrew Bergman, who wrote the screenplay for the film, which I never saw, by the way. And he has done such a excellent job of adapting it and, you know, cutting and reworking. How often does that happen, that it's successful and that it's done by the person who wrote the screenplay? I mean, is this like maybe the first time in history? If not, maybe it's the second or third. There were so many ways that this could have gone off the rails, but I think they just it's an amazing success. The only things remotely negative that I would say are, you know, probably in the I'm sure it's in the source material. I was a little taken aback by the fact that it seems like they want to kind of have it both ways with the Tony Danza character, that he's supposed to be you're supposed to think that he has the potential to really be menacing and that he's actually a mobster and maybe even a killer, you know, even if he doesn't kill himself, that he can order people to be killed. And yet he's also supposed to be an incredibly charming guy, a crooner kind of guy, which Tony Danza is. So I think that's a little odd, and I maybe if either of you saw the movie with James Caan, maybe you can tell me if it was the same in the movie. But but given that, I thought that they did it as well as you could possibly expect, and Tony Danza was so perfect. He was so smooth and so charming, and yet he did give I suppose he gave the hints of menace. And I must say, as I said to actually, Mark Hobie, who's one of the higher ups at the producing artistic director at Paper Mill, I did see one of Tony Danza's club acts, and although he was wonderfully charismatic and charming and everyone loved him, the actual singing was really, really not that good. In his club act, I mean, there was a lot of notes that were really not on pitch, etc. But in this case, he really must have worked his tail off, because I thought he sounded fantastic. And the only thing when he's crooning, which is most of his stuff, it sounds lovely and very, very, very good. The only thing it seems he can't do is he can't really belt, you know, like really belt out a high note. But he had people working with him who are so smart: director Gary Griffin, choreographer Dennis Jones. I'm looking for the musical director here. Tom Murray. They're so smart, you know. They play to his strengths, and they there's a moment in Act Two where Tony's character has a big number, and then it gets to the end of it, and you think, well, it's going to come to a big ending, you know? Is he going to be able to belt out those notes? And what they do is they bring Matthew Saldivar on stage, who plays his sort of henchman, and it's suddenly for the last whatever, 20 measures becomes a duet. And so Matthew is able to provide the, you know, the vocal muscle, that extra bit that's needed for the, to really cap the number and make it a showstopper. And they sing in harmony at the end, and it just, it's, you know, it's just perfect. So I was so, you know, it's, when you see something like this, you think, oh, you know, it must be, you know, it looks so easy to write a show. You know, it looks so easy to write it and cast it, and you know, it looks so effortless when it's done well. And then you see something that's not, and you see, and you think, oh gosh, you know, it's really amazing how sometimes the pieces just fall together perfectly with the right people in the right roles and the right creative jobs. And this is one of those cases. I think it could be almost another producer's. I really do.
Peter, what did you think?
I liked it very much as well. given that Michael is mentioning the Elvis number, I'm going to say that's one I think that could be better. But I should really stress the assets first. Rob McClure, I think, is giving a perfect performance, and I mean that. I don't think there's one iota of a tenth of a second that's out of place in this performance. Every line, every song that he has, he delivers perfectly. I wouldn't mind seeing him getting another big number, expressing himself better. Let's talk about the property itself. Yes, I did see the movie. And it is about a young man who promises his mother on her deathbed that indeed he will never, ever, ever get married. But then he falls in love. What can he do? You know, and he doesn't know what to do. And of course, after 5-year engagement, the young woman is certainly interested in getting married, to say the least. And she's pressuring him into it. One of the things that happens in the movie is that out of the blue, finally, he says, all right, let's go to Las Vegas and get married. Well, why Las Vegas? Now, at least here in the musical, they have friends who are getting married. And, of course, that's another complication, because while they are not even remotely planning to get married, they run into these friends who are getting married. And there's nothing worse for somebody who wants to get married than to find out your good friend is getting married. I mean, that's the, so that's a nice little setup there. And they said, we're going to Las Vegas to get married. So as a result, that puts the idea in the head of going to Las Vegas. So, I mean, there are little touches like that throughout the show. This is really a case where the movie has been improved, that Andrew Bergman has really given more thought to these characters and have fleshed out every now and then little touches, nothing major, but nevertheless, an improvement. And how often can we say that in a musical? It's a good fun time show. This may be a terrible thing to say, but it has occurred to me, so I'll say it. It may be the type of show that gets 10 Tony nominations and doesn't win one or two. It's because it is a good time, fast paced musical comedy. I will also tell you that yesterday I had lunch with a friend who was telling me he was at their tech rehearsal, on Tuesday night. And he said he finally had to leave at 11 o'clock because they hadn't gotten through the show. He usually goes to their tech rehearsals and finds that they come out and they say in advance, well, you know, we may have to stop, you know, and it turns out that they rarely do. Here they were stopping endlessly, and that's amazing to me, because Sunday night, this show was so slick. It looked like it never had a care in the world. It moved like lightning. It was really, really something to hear that from this guy, to think that they really pulled it all together so beautifully. Because if there's one thing this show does, it really does move like the wind, and on a hurricane day, in fact. I had a wonderful time, and I think it's going to bring a lot of pleasure to a lot of people. I can't imagine it's going to be too much time before we see it here, and I think it'll do extraordinarily well with a good number of people who enjoy this type of show. Again, nothing groundbreaking, but it does everything it sets out to do. It wants to give you a good time, and it certainly delivers what it promises.
Peter, when you said that about maybe not winning any Tonys, do you mean because musical comedies sometimes don't get?
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean. I mean, it's it will be considered a popular success rather than any type of breakthrough or anything like that. It just doesn't want to be. It'll be very interesting, of course, to see if it's up against The Bridges of Madison County.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah, we have no idea if indeed, you know, this will happen. I mean, so many times we make predictions about what's going to happen. It doesn't remotely happen.
Well, someone online said, isn't it ironic that Jason Robert Brown's biggest competition for the Tony is himself?
Sure. Sure. Yeah. Well, Michael John had that a few years ago, too, with Wild Party and Marie Christine. Yeah.
I do think that it will come to New York. I think that there's a logjam of theaters, and I think it'll be very, very difficult to get a theater that's appropriate for it this year.
I'm hearing the Palace.
Yeah, that's a lot. That's pretty big. It's a shame that and certainly every now and then people mention the Broadway that Cinderella may not last, and that would be even more problematic. But I'm sorry, the Broadhurst is booked with Mamma Mia. Of course, many people are sad. Mamma Mia is still going, but that's another story. But the fact is that that would be a nice house for it.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I do agree that I certainly do agree that the Palace and the Broadway are very, very large and maybe too large for anything. But if you look at it the other way, and you look at shows that would be most appropriate for those spaces, I think this one is, because it's, even though it may not be huge in terms of cast size, it's just a very big, brassy, show with big emotions and a lot of broad comedy. So in that sense, I think that if something is going to play the Palace, it might as well be this. But, but who knows? Anything can happen between now and April.
And those doomsayers who say the big fish won't last.
Right.
And we don't know because we didn't see it the other night when we were supposed to. Michael, did you have the same experience?
Yes, I was supposed to go on Thursday.
Yeah, uh-huh. I was supposed to go Wednesday. And so all of us haven't seen Big Fish yet because Norbert was out sick and they rescheduled press tickets. So
sick to the point at which you couldn't finish the Wednesday matinee.
Yes.
Yeah. So anyway, but the point is there are those who say Big Fish won't last, and we have no opinion, we certainly don't wish them ill. But nevertheless, this would be a very good show for the Neil Simon Theater. And again, I even hate to bring that up because let Big Fish have its chance.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so let's wrap it up for here. As Peter just mentioned, hopefully next week we'll get to talk about Big Fish. Michael and I saw the Classic Stage Company production of Romeo and Juliet, which opens up this Wednesday or Tuesday?
The 16th,
16th. So we are going to talk about that again next week. Maybe Peter will get a chance to see it this week as well. So we'll talk about Romeo and Juliet at Classic Stage and Big Fish next week, as well as some other stuff. And rumor has it on the horizon. I'm not sure if it's going to be next week or sometime later in the future. Laura Benanti is going to come visit us. So, and she's got her new CD out as well. So we're going to be talking about that. So let me wrap up here and tell everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If you want to listen to us in another way, you can listen to us on Stitcher, which is an application for your iPhone, your Android device, your BlackBerry, where you can stream This Week on Broadway directly to your device. We also are played on Broadway World Radio, Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m., and if you are interested in seeing links to some of the things that we've talked about today, they are all at BroadwayRadio.com. And I've included the video of Creeptastic, the Skivvies featuring Jeremy Jordan on our page there, so you can find it very easily, as well as links to Jason and Lauren's websites and Twitter accounts and other various things. A place where you can actually click and buy Marry Me a Little, the cast recording as well from the King Company. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantiere, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
But not with trumpets or lightning flashing or shining armor. He may be daring, he may be dashing, or maybe he's a farmer. We can wait, what's another day? He has lots of hills to climb. and I can't even say that I care. All I know is the minute you turn and he's suddenly there.